this week on COVID, Race, and Democracy.
But seeing people get sick and die, even though they had the vaccine, I think that's what's causing people to have a lot of alarm and hesitancy.
We look at the struggles over COVID vaccine mandates for workers.
It is a scientific reality that if there was will, we could eliminate this virus.
And we'll examine the policy of COVID zero that will seek to eliminate the virus in the United States.
We didn't formally, propose that the Delegate Assembly absolutely support the idea of VBS, but that everybody needed to discuss it.
We'll hear about the struggle in labor movements and unions to support Palestinians and the boycott of Israel by the AFL-CIO and the American Federation of Teachers.
We'll hear the U.S. argue that Assange is not a suicide risk if extradited to the U.S. for espionage and hacking charges carrying multiple life sentences, and is instead a malingerer.
And an update on the case of imprisoned WikiLeaks publisher Julian Assange. From Pacifica Radio, this is COVID, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from Pacifica stations and radio affiliates. I'm your host, Paulina Vasiliev. The Biden government, along with many employers throughout the country, have sought to implement a vaccine mandate. This comes after over 700,000 COVID deaths in the United States, according to official statistics. New York transit workers have faced the brunt of the pandemic. Transit Worker Union TWU Executive Board Member Evangeline Byers spoke to Pacifica's Steve Zeltzer about the conditions that workers face and management's response.
In 2020, we know the COVID-19 pandemic hit us. And at New York City Transit, which is a part of the MTA, we had over 160 workers that we lost due to the pandemic. Not only that, in the early days of the pandemic, Transit, the MTA, refused to give us PPE to ensure our safety. It wasn't into a good while into the pandemic that they decided that they would now adhere to the pandemic policy plan that they had already since 2012. They then enacted it and started using it, but they had, for a long time, they refused to give us PPE. The MTA is its own animal, right? And one of the things that we see when it comes to workers everywhere, right, that everything that you have to struggle and fight and resist for, right? And so the MTA has this heavy-handedness towards its workforce, where unless it is forced upon them and everything has to say that they have to do it, they do nothing by will. Everything that they do is towards their workforce is by force. So they had to adhere to the 2012 pandemic policy plan because it had become public and made known to the members that they had this plan. And so once we knew about it and it started circulating, they then decided to start to give out masks and things of that nature. Our members were already dying. The first case was located in my division, which is RTO, the train operators division.
And what does that say? I mean, is there testing? Is there mass protocol for testing of the workers in transit, MTA?
The governor controls the state and the mayors control the city. New York City Transit, the MTA, we are subject to the jurisdiction of the governor. And the governor of New York State has not mandated the workforce to vaccinate. What we've been doing at New York City Transit is we have to get tested weekly. Everyone is subject to weekly testing. And for those who want to be vaccinated, you can be vaccinated. And so we have not been, vaccines have not been forced on us.
And what happens if somebody becomes gets the COVID?
Well, actually, We have a large amount of our members who have been vaccinated who are coming back COVID positive, who are now testing positive for COVID. So even though they've been vaccinated, people are still getting sick. A large majority of our workforce has taken the vaccine, and many of them have gone out sick and still have tested positive for COVID. So prevention is still mask, hand washing, sanitizer, and basically making sure you take care of your immune health, because we know that those with underlying conditions are the ones who are severely impacted by COVID. And so most of us are doing is, you know, practicing safe protocol, wearing our masks, washing our hands and things of that nature, cleaning down our area. We all use Lysol on our trains and things of that nature. And everybody's subject to weekly testing. However, what I think that the NTA is doing a poor job in administering the weekly testing. We have a vast system, but they have testing locations. There should be more testing going on at these sites, right? Making it more available for the workforce to be able to take these tests. And the dissemination of the testing sites, of letting the members know where to go get tested, right? A lot of people still are going out on their own time and they'll just run into like a CityMD and test. And then other people are taking their weekly tests at work.
Well, the Biden administration and CDC are saying that the solution is going to be vaccines. Do you believe that the solution to this pandemic is going to be vaccines?
This is my take on it. I think that everyone should be vaccinated, right? But people who have underlying health conditions and people who are need religious exemptions should be able to be exempt. If you have pre-existing health conditions, and you have, and also from COVID, a lot of people are developing this heart condition called myocarditis, which is connected to people who have had COVID. I believe that people have the right to have a choice, right? If you want to take the vaccine, you can be vaccinated. But remember, vaccines, usually when you're vaccinated from something, you never get it again. I can never get measles because I'm vaccinated. I'll never get mumps because I'm vaccinated. I'll never get rubella because I'm vaccinated. I won't get polio because I'm vaccinated. But with this COVID-19 vaccine, they have not made the vaccine to where once you are vaccinated, you no longer get sick, right? So how do we know? How can you force people to do something that is not going to guarantee that they never get sick again, right? Another thing about this vaccine, they have now dubbed it a jab, right? Oh, did you get a jab? Now they're talking about booster shots. When is the medical science going to be geared towards making sure that we eradicate COVID-19? That's what vaccines usually do, right? Eradicate disease. You cannot get it anymore. And so I think that the Biden administration should start putting pressure on the scientists to use the methods that they used in the past that ensured once you were vaccinated, you no longer were susceptible to get it again. If we get back to that, I think that people would be more comfortable. But seeing people get sick and die, even though they had the vaccine, I think that's what's causing people to have a lot of alarm and hesitancy. This is a democracy that we live in, right? Anything that is happening to us is supposed to be a choice. We're not supposed to be forced and mandated. And if you're going to mandate us to take a vaccine, at least we should be protected that after we take this vaccine, we will never have to worry about COVID-19 again. But that is not what science is showing us. Well, that's the thing. One of the things, a part of my campaign, just to let you know, I was disqualified from running for president of my union because they found a way to force me into bad standing. I was sick due to COVID back in 2020 and had a reoccurring health issue and had to go out on a reoccurring injury. And I fell into what is called no pay status and missed one dues payment. The union is supposed to notify me, and they did not. As a result of that, one missed payment sat for 2 months until I discovered it. Once I discovered it, I paid it. But the union says you weren't in continuous good standing, and now you can't run for president. We have a whole court case going on. But this lets you know where unions are at this point, right? They are trying to stay in control, stay in charge of by any means necessary. A lot of these union heads of unions are compromised, right? They're in it for the dollars, the financial gain, for what it is that they can do. They have neglected the workforce. Across this country, you hear no outcry from any unions about the fact that Joe Biden did not write in unions in his CARES Act, right? You forced unionized, especially the transportation workers, to work throughout the pandemic and would not even give us hazard pay, right? And so we've gotten no protection. The AFL-CIO is right there in Washington. No public statement or outcry from anyone. And right now, with all of these mandates happening, you hear no unions standing with their members on this matter.
That was Evangeline Byers, Transit Workers Union Executive Board Member.
You are listening to COVID, Race, and Democracy. Find out more about our work at our website, covidtaskforce.pacifica.org.
One issue that has not been discussed or reported much by legacy media is a zero COVID policy that would eliminate the virus. Family physician and public health doctor Navin Gordon talks about this public health policy.
We know there is extremely widespread virus throughout the entire country, and the data is being suppressed. It's insufficient, incomplete, inaccurate, and being suppressed. Since everything's been opened up for the last 3 or 4 months, we can assume it is almost everywhere. The numbers of people that have died, not only been infected, but died, is vastly underestimated. The Scientific American and The Economist both said the numbers in the U.S. probably are well over 1 million deaths. The picture is much worse than what they're painting it as. And the other point is that it's clearly related to the profit motive and how that's panned out since 1980. I think the key to this is 1980, the World Bank basically issued a new policy, and that is that they would privatize health and privatize public health systems throughout the world. And as a result, in the last 40 years, they basically decimated public health systems throughout the world and in favor of treatment. So this pandemic shows clearly what that means for them. What it means is that any epidemic coming will kill as many as it needs to kill. If the death rate is, 1%, then we're going to lose 1%. It won't change anything in my mind if the next virus comes through and it's 10 times worse. There's no infrastructure to do anything other than what they're doing now. So we'll lose, instead of 1 million in a year or so, we're going to lose 10 million while they're busy trying to figure out what new vaccine they can create and what kind of drugs they can use to treat it. So from my point of view, we're in a period now where mass epidemics created basically by the profit systems, industrial agriculture and food raising has moved into the natural world in such a way that these viruses are now ripping through our society. So it's very clear that there's a major attack on zero COVID, because initially they went, the powers that be went along with the scientific community, said, we've got to do something. Let's do the old public health 101. And so they went with that, but it became very clear that that's too expensive. They can't make any money doing that. So now there's a massive campaign throughout the world to try and attempt to get every country that has successfully carried out COVID, zero COVID policies, to turn it around and let them live with the virus. That's their new thing. We're going to just live with it. It's going to be here forever. So therefore, the pressure on New Zealand has intensified, Singapore also, and, assume that they're going to try and push zero COVID out everywhere. It's clear that the science behind zero COVID is absolutely true. There's no question about the fact that it is a scientific reality that if there was will, we could eliminate this virus. But what I see is that the only force possible that would eliminate, institute zero COVID is the working people. So for me, I think the key thing is how workers need to protect themselves with rank and file health committees of some type, which, you know, demand on the job protection, which could incorporate a lot of the issues of zero COVID policy. In other words, we will have an organization that has to obviously fight the corporate unions because they're not doing anything about it. So it has to be a rank and file health committee that organizes their co-workers to say, look, we cannot come to work if you refuse to daily test for COVID. We cannot come to work if someone is COVID positive and is allowed to work here. We cannot come to work unless you pay people to stay home if they're COVID positive for quarantine. We cannot come to work if you don't include ventilation, if you don't include HEPA filters. In other words, the basic structure that we need to protect ourselves at work has to be demanded on the job. And I see that as the only way we're going to get out of this pickle that we're in and protect us from not only this virus, but the next one that's coming.
That was Dr. Navin Gordon, a public health doctor in Northern California who has worked in Native American communities. A self-fulfilling prophecy, system collapse and the pandemic simulation is the title of an article by Dr. Fabio Vigi, professor of critical theory and Italian at Cardiff University in the United Kingdom. He discussed the political economy of the pandemic with journalist and author Max Blumenthal. I
think we are probably experiencing a kind of a paradigm shift in the way in which capitalism works. So I think capitalism is now pushing. And here, again, I'm not being a conspiracy theorist because I'm talking about the actual system, right? I'm talking about a kind of anonymous system that reproduces itself, in this case, by turning more authoritarian, potentially totalitarian, right? In order to survive, it's almost like an evolutionary direction, right? It's a kind of, it does it by evolutionary inertia. In order to survive, it needs to become more authoritarian. I think that's where we are at the moment. So that's why what we're seeing is this kind of monetary policies. We're seeing the shrinking of the real economy, maybe even the planned demolition of the real economy, because I don't think that the real economy can be saved really from this situation. So maybe what's happening is that there's a kind of controlled demolition of maybe. Of course, they knew about inflation, right? How could they must have known about rising inflation. They put so much money into the financial sector. Of course, some of this money will leak because it's a credit-based economy, the one we're in. So we need to borrow, right? And we need to borrow from banks, and banks bet on the financial markets all the time. So there is a connection between, you know, the digital money created for the banks and the financial sector and the money we spend on the ground.
Right.
Some of that money leaks. So they must have known about inflation. And that's why I'm talking about controlled demolition of the real economy, which might be the way in which they think that, well, they, the system thinks that it can reproduce itself, right? By kind of destroying the real economy, creating a kind of new feudal society with monetary control from top down. Yeah. And that seems to coincide very nicely with the rolling out of the digital infrastructure, the so-called digital transition. Because a digital transition and the use of blockchain, ledgers, etc., allows for direct control, or would potentially allow for direct control, monetary control, and the creation of a social, you know, credit system, like already we have in China,
right,
to an extent, right? And that would just bypass politics completely. It would just be a question of connecting the guys who are in charge of monetary policy, so central bankers essentially, and people on the ground who would be tied to these kind of digital wallets.
Digital wallets connected digital to your wallets immunity connect. Passport, connected to your driver's license or your ID.
Everything.
You can be completely cut off from society if you do not comply.
Right. From that angle, you can think of why they may be accelerating the demolition of the real economy, right? Because that leads precisely to that scenario. And you can add things to that. You can add, for example, the ecological crisis, the kind of the green transition, because that also plays in their hands, as we know. There's such a thing as financial greenwashing, right? So a lot of new debt can be created precisely by playing that sort of card of ecological card, etc.
So what is the role of lockdowns in all of this? I mean, many people who are smart, who I know, including very smart economists, think that lockdowns are just necessary to quote unquote flatten the curve.
I think that it's about the economy much more than it's about microbiology, right? And I think that's what people don't want to prefer not to know about, prefer not to understand in a way, right? It's too scary, I guess. I think maybe it's just too scary to think of this level of manipulation, but I think it's actually going on. And as the mechanism, as I said, is quite simple. It's about preventing, or it's about controlling inflation, ultimately, deferring hyperinflation, because hyperinflation would have been the obvious consequence of reopening the economy all of a sudden and declaring COVID defeated, as it were. That would have caused a massive hyperinflation of the kind that we saw in Weimar in the 1920s in Germany. And we know very well what happened after that, right? With the kind of that hyperinflation sort of ushering in the Third Reich. So that is something that they wanted to prevent at all costs. And I think that's why we've got not only COVID, but we've got the variants, right? A series of variants that effectively allowed for the iteration of virus. Right, I call it virus as a sort of entity. But it really allowed for more closures, more restrictions, the very cautious reopening of certain sectors of the economy, as you said. If you think of a travel industry, it's been, you know, devastated in many ways, right? The tourist industry and so on. Many others, the retail sectors. That also allowed for the destruction of small businesses and medium-sized businesses, right? And of course, the destruction of those businesses translated into channeling those economic resources into financial assets. So it was really mopped up by the financial elites quite directly there. So once again, it's an obvious point to make. The elites are getting more and more powerful out of this, whilst the economy on the ground is being destroyed. Is being destroyed. And I think there's probably some kind of intentionality there, I would say, right? There's some kind of controlled demolition going on. And clearly, the coronavirus plays on people's, well, it's about fear, isn't it? So people kind of willingly go along with the restrictions and they don't question, right? When it's about those levels of fear and those levels of propaganda, people don't even question, they just obey, right? But the more they obey, the more difficult it is to get out of the situation. I think we're still in this. I think those who really are the puppet masters, as it were, right? They are procrastinating. At the moment, they are just buying time. They don't really know what to do next. And that's why they still need virus. They still need some forms of emergency. They still need some closures. They still need the stick of what I call emergency capitalism. Whether it comes through the virus, maybe virus is just the appetizer, right? And there would be more emergencies developing. Because ultimately, I think it's if the solution for them is to demolish the economy and bring in the digital infrastructure, then they need to make sure that they synchronize the two things very carefully, right? So the demolition of the economy needs to be synchronized with the rolling out of the digital infrastructure. So the timing is of the essence in this case. And I think that's where we are at the moment. I think this, we're still kind of, they are still sort of procrastinating. They're still buying time and seeing what they can do. Whilst, of course, there are some critical issues to deal with, like inflation, of course, like rising inflation, which is not going away.
That was Cardiff University professor Fabio Vigi speaking with author and journalist Max Blumenthal. To hear their full conversation, go to rockfin.com and look for the Foreign Agents podcast. La-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-
night and every day now. Never meaning what they say now. Never saying what they mean. While they while away the hours in their ivory towers, till they're covered up with flowers in the back of a black limousine. Whoa, la da da. Talking about you and me and the games people play now. Will we make one another cry? Break a heart and we say goodbye. Cross our hearts and we hope to die. That the other was to blame. Whoa, but neither one will ever give in. So we gaze at an 8x10, thinking about the things that might have been. And it's a dirty, rotten shame. Whoa, la da 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 da.
That was Games People Play by Joe South. You're listening to Pacifica's COVID, Race, and Democracy. I'm your host, Paulina Vasiliev. Pacifica producer Steve Zeltzer spoke to Professor Carol Lang on the attack on democracy by the Zionists and the union officials of the City University of New York, American Federation of Teachers Professional Staff Council.
There has been a backlash against trade unionists, workers who have supported the Palestinians and passed resolutions. And this happened in CUNY in New York, AFT-PSC. And we're going to talk about it because it's important to show the role of the supporters of Israel and Zionism, how they operate in the labor movement. So welcome, Carol.
Hi, Steve.
So Carol, why don't you talk about your resolution that was passed, your fight in your local for that, and what happened?
Well, it has quite a sordid history. We, in the International Committee, wrote a resolution with the support of the Anti-Racism Committee and the Academic Freedom Committee in support of the Palestinians, pure and simple. And so when we presented it to the Executive Committee, they went like ballistic and ended up rewriting the resolution, taking out everything that we put in about the aggression against the Palestinians on the part of the Israelis. And so the resolution was completely different from what they had. Was is this is a multi-ethnic state, and you know, I mean it was just had nothing in it that condemned Israel for attacking Gaza. So it came back to some of the people who wrote the resolution. And we wrote amendments before the delegate assembly. We wrote amendments to the resolution, putting in some of the stuff that was taken out by the executive committee. But because we didn't have time to put everything in, we couldn't put the Histadrut in and other kinds of things. But enough of it made it palpable and, you know, militant to for us to be okay with it. So we brought it to the delegate assembly. And it passed overwhelmingly, 84 to 32. It was like, you know, yes, of course. So after that, the Zionists went nuts and they started taking pictures of names of people in the chat and sending it to the Post. The New York Post is a very conservative newspaper. The Clarion, which is my newspaper, ended up, because they had part of the resolution was that we were going to have a debate, but they put more of the letters that were anti the resolution as opposed to letters that were pro resolution. So it was biased from the very jump. And the president, James Davis, is the guy that wrote the editorial about the resolution. But part of the resolution said that each chapter should discuss the question of BDS. And so we didn't formally, you know, propose that the delegate assembly absolutely support the idea of BDS, but that everybody needed to discuss it. And so, of course, that never happened. And no chapters, as far as I know, have discussed the question of BDS. But the Zionists were calling up the union, the principled officers, saying that they're going to leave the union because this was anti-democratic, and the membership didn't have a discussion on it first. So a couple of hundred people left the union who were, in my opinion, anti-union. I mean, you don't leave if you don't lose a vote. But after the whole thing happened and these people are leaving, the principled officers went nuts and were frightened of the members. And so not only are they sitting on every committee, right, to watch over the committees, I just found out the anti-bullying committee has three principled officers on it, but they ended up writing a resolution saying that resolutions have to be more democratic, and therefore we can't write resolutions. Not only can we not write resolutions like this anymore, but every resolution has to go from one DA to the next DA, which is a month later. And so we had a meeting yesterday to talk about their resolution and amendments to their resolution, but they had people were in the delegate assembly were so unsympathetic, and they hadn't gotten the resolution saying that we need to discuss resolutions out to people early enough that it ended up getting tabled. So that's where things are at this point.
And we're talking with Carol Lang, who is a faculty member at CUNY. And CUNY has a large Black population, brown population. It's under attack. And the leader of the AFT, Randy Weingarten, recently met with Liz Schuller, the head of the AFL-CIO, and also the leader of the Labor Party in Israel, saying that they wanted to make sure that their progressive politics in the AFL-CIO and the AFT. What exactly does that mean? Because for those who don't know, the AFL-CIO sent a letter to the San Francisco Labor Council saying that they could not even talk about a resolution opposing Israel's policies and supporting a boycott of Israel. What's going on in the AFL-CIO, the AFT, and the trade union leadership to prevent even a discussion debate on the issue of Zionism?
Well, it seems to me that the AFL is really a dictatorship, because if the locals are not allowed to go in opposition to the AFL policy, which is the policy of the American government, because the AFL receives millions and millions, I don't even know how many countless millions.
$75 million.
This year. But over the course of years and years, they've received, I would like for them to open their books, but they have intervened historically in anti-communist struggles around the world. And there's no opposing them because they say there's no opposing us. So as far as I'm concerned, this is a dictatorship, and the members of the union have to learn that this is happening so that we can get rid of the structures that are keeping workers in this country and around the world oppressed.
And why would the AFL-CIO leadership tie their support for U.S. imperialist policies around the world in Venezuela? The U.S. is trying to overthrow it. There's sanctions on Libya. There were sanctions on Libya. There were sanctions on Iran. There are sanctions on
everywhere.
Cuba, even on China, they have sanctions. I mean, it seems that the U.S. government has put sanctions on that have cost the lives of hundreds of thousands of people, millions of people in Iraq. Madeleine Albright, who was the Secretary of State, said that the sanctions on the Iraqi people led to the death of 600,000 children. What kind of government is that? What kind of situation is that?
Well, I think the United States historically, especially since World War II, has had dominance over the world politics and has had hegemony. But now the U.S. government is losing its hegemony, and people are starting to go their own way and fight against the American government. And in order to be able to control the situation internationally, the U.S. government uses the American labor to prevent things from happening in other countries. If U.S. labor understood its power, it would shut everything down. The United States government would not be able to proceed with its anti-communist, anti-independent, anti you know, radical politics that it's been pursuing. It's the AFL that's allowing the American government really fundamentally to continue to prop up reactionary governments like Guaido in Venezuela. And so, you know, they make a lot of money, not only from the US government and from the CIA, but they're in positions where, you know, many of them, Randy Weingarten, who's the head of the AFT, has a salary of $500,000 a year. There are people in her union that make $25,000, $30,000 a year. I think it's obscene. And the only way that they can continue in these very privileged positions, if they organize bureaucratic institutions that hold the membership back from fighting for, you know, their rights. Because once they start to do that, it jeopardizes that Randy Weingarten and Schuller and all of those people's positions of power.
And they support billions of dollars of aid to Israel, U.S. military and economic aid. At the same time, in New York, public union officials have been involved in trying to work with the insurance companies, cutting healthcare benefits for public workers. Why don't you talk about that struggle? Because it would seem that while they have this international policy of supporting U.S. imperial interest, at the same time, they're collaborating with the insurance companies for privatization of Medicare. Is that true?
Well, they're basically pro-capitalist. And so their policies are not actually contradictory in terms of domestic policies and international policies. So de Blasio, who's the mayor, wanted to save $600 million a year. And the way to do that was to hand people who have Medicare over to private insurance companies so that the city can now wash its hands of providing its support towards the piece of the insurance that Medicare doesn't cover. So Medicare covers 80%. The city was covering 20%, and now the city is absolved of having to deal with that 20%. The unions, of course, went behind the backs for 3 years of the workers and made this deal with de Blasio to essentially put us in the hands of these privatized companies that, you know, I mean, insurance companies make a lot of money because they don't pay. And nobody is stupid. And a lot of the city workers are upset. So people put in a lawsuit against the city and against this, you know, these privatized companies. But what the judge said yesterday, actually, was that once all of the ducks are in the row and all the insurance companies have met whatever their criteria that they're supposed to meet, then they can actually take us out of Medicare and put us into a privatized company. So a number of people are thinking, well, this is a victory, but it's a stay of execution, in my opinion, because ultimately we're going to end up, rather than fighting for single payer, which is what I've been advocating for all of these months, you know, people are disheartened. So they're hoping that the courts will intervene and fix things for us. But this is how the courts fix things for us, by saying we're going to stay the execution. So you won't get your head chopped off just yet.
So this is the president of the United Federation of Teachers, Mulgrew, the Teamsters leadership. And I understand one of the Teamsters officials, Local 237, was actually taking money from the insurance companies.
So he's on the officials, board. He's on the board of the insurance company of Emblem.
And so he's getting money from Emblem, this insurance company, at the same time that he's saying that the workers should not be paid by the agency they work for. Instead, they should be reliant on the insurance company to take care of their healthcare needs.
Exactly. So things are really, people are now, pockets of people all over the place are pretty angry about a variety of different things, but it's palpable that things are, that people are pretty upset about what's happening. People have worked 40 years, right? 50 years to be not know whether whatever you've gotten. I have a friend that worked around the World Trade Center. So she has cancer. And now she has to go to a private company in order to try to get whatever she needs in order to make sure that she doesn't die of cancer. Two types of cancer she has.
And we're talking to Carol Lang, and the issue of the Democratic Party, which has supported this policy. You have been a supporter of the Labor Party, of unions having their own political party. Do you think this is connected to the fight both for the Palestinians and also the economic attacks that workers are facing in this country?
Well, I mean, for me, I think that workers of the world must unite because we have nothing to lose but our chains. And that unless workers stand up for Palestinians and for people around the world.
Korea.
There was just a general strike in Korea of 500,000 people. The Korean workers are suffering in the same way as American workers are. They're being shortchanged, their contract labor, the Korean, thankfully, their union leadership is at least fighting for the entire working class, unlike the union leadership in the United States, which is basically attempting to undermine our struggle. But if we don't all fight together, then the capitalists win. That's just the long and the short of it. And I don't think we have a whole lot of time, given the environment and, you know, the state of the economy, to be, you know, hoping that maybe some Democrat will come along and save us when, in fact, they support the bourgeoisie themselves.
That was Professor Carol Lang talking about the struggle in her local for Palestinian rights and about the attacks on public workers in New York who are facing privatization of their health care to save costs for the city of New York.
Changes. Don't tell them to blow up on out of it.
That was Changes by David Bowie. This is Pacifica's COVID, Race, and Democracy. I'm Paulina Vasiliev. This week, imprisoned journalist WikiLeaks publisher Julian Assange is facing a hearing in the U.S. extradition case against him. Pacifica's Thomas O'Rourke has the following update.
For COVID, Race, and Democracy, this is Thomas O'Rourke. Assange extradition process reconvenes this week. Julian Assange's U.S. extradition process continues this Wednesday, October 27th, with a two-day hearing at the Royal Courts of Justice in London. This appeals hearing will hear the U.S. argue that Assange is not a suicide risk if extradited to the U.S. for espionage and hacking charges carrying multiple life sentences, and is instead a malingerer. Assange's legal team will counter with, among other recent public developments, the explosive revelations in Yahoo News last month detailing U.S. intelligence agencies, especially the CIA, engaging in detailed high-level planning and discussions over scenarios and options to kidnap, render, and even assassinate Assange and any protectors in what some compare to spy thriller cinematic techniques. Additionally, the defense will likely raise the status of Icelandic convicted child sex offender and key U.S. witness to the conspiracy to hack charge against Assange. Sigurdur Sigi Thordarson was arrested in Reykjavik on September 24th and is currently being held under a rarely used Icelandic law, allowing indefinite detention of a subject thought to be engaged in an ongoing crime spree. This was reported by Icelandic news magazine Stundin at the time. Stundin had published an interview with Sigi in June, in which he recanted as completely false his January testimony to the British extradition court, asserting Assange's complicity in computer hacking. Other recent developments in the case include the naming of two High Court judges who will be sitting for this week's appeals hearing. The Royal Courts announced that the most senior judge in England and Wales, the Baron Burnett of Maldon, Ian Duncan Burnett, will join Lord Justice Timothy Holyrood on the bench for this week's hearing. The judge's appointments seem to presage contradiction. Justice Baron Burnett ruled in 2018 to overturn on humanitarian grounds the extradition of a British activist to the U.S. for reasons of mental and physical anguish, severe depression, and the potential for suicide. Justice Holyrood, on the other hand, heard and reversed an earlier High Court order that limited the U.S. from appealing the court's findings on Assange's medical issues. The U.S. had appealed Judge Vanessa Baritzer's January ruling, refusing extradition, due mainly to concerns for Assange's mental and physical health, and Judge Holyrood agreed to allow the U.S. to contest these grounds, which will be scrutinized at this week's hearing. What's unusual about Holyrood's continued involvement in the process is that he has ruled on behalf of one of the parties at the earlier stage in August, and thus to preside over this later stage calls into question his objectivity and is and will be seen as highly unusual. But certainly Assange's lawyers will cite the bombshell story from Yahoo News on the 26th of September by a team led by veteran journalist and prominent Russiagate promoter Michael Isikoff, detailing CIA and Trump administration officials' determined and illegal efforts to stop Assange and WikiLeaks. The piece explains that it was WikiLeaks' so-called Vault 7 revelations in 2017, exposing the existence of CIA hacking tools to serve its goal of worldwide surveillance on any targeted person, that enraged the then director Mike Pompeo and spurred him to begin, though in fact it was simply a continuation from the Obama administration, to work to raise the threat level assigned to Assange and WikiLeaks and thus ramp up U.S. national intelligence efforts against them. Assange's lawyers will argue that these revelations of CIA misconduct should convince the court of the malfeasance and criminality of the U.S. government's ultimate intentions towards Assange. Unfortunately, many of the revelations of the Yahoo article aren't revelations at all. A criminal court case in Spain against Spanish security firm UC Global was covered by the Gray Zone website in May 2020, in which it was revealed that the head of the company had turned his contract to protect the Ecuadorian embassy in London, and by extension, its political refugee Assange, into a surveillance counterintelligence operation for the CIA against Assange. UC Global employees testified against their boss, David Morales, that he worked with CIA personnel to plan rendition and assassination scenarios, including the possible poisoning of Assange. Additionally, UC Global embassy security surveilled every interaction between Assange and his friends and supporters, media personnel, and his legal team, as well as his secret relationship with partner and mother of their two children, Stella Morris. All of this taken together should lead the British High Court to release Assange immediately and stop forever U.S. processes against him and WikiLeaks. But that is far from certain. For COVID, Race, and Democracy, this is Thomas O'Rourke.
just after the bombshell revelations about the CIA plot to kidnap and assassinate WikiLeaks publisher Julian Assange while he sought political asylum in the Ecuadorian embassy in London, the Belmarsh Tribunal held its first face-to-face session at the London Convocation Hall to judge the U.S. government for its crimes against humanity in the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, and for the imprisonment of Julian Assange, who revealed such information. With this process, the Belmarsh Court emulates the Bertrand Russell, John Paul Sartre People's Court, which sat in Stockholm and Copenhagen in 1967 to try the White House for war crimes in Vietnam. We'll now hear from some of those who testified at the Belmarsh Tribunal.
The Belmarsh Tribunal does both. It reveals the crimes of the United States, and it also reveals the crimes that the United States has perpetrated, not just abroad, but also closer to home here in Britain, where Julian Assange, an award-winning journalist and publisher, is held in a maximum security prison and treated extremely badly and tortured. One of the important things about the Assange case is the silence of the mainstream media in the past in relation to what grave criminality has taken place, including attempts to buy the prosecuting party to poison, kidnap the defendant. And this tribunal is seeking to build on that momentum and get him into the mainstream discourse. Most ordinary people that I talk to recognize that what is being done to Assange is a grave injustice. And we have to show that we are not going to sit back and watch this happening, but that we are coming together to push back against it as a collective.
He is not safe, even if the extradition is quashed. Of course, I would be very happy for him to see him walk free out of prison. But the ordeal is not over, and the ordeal of journalists all over the world is not over, because until the Biden administration does the right thing and drop the case against Julian Assange, there is a looming danger for all journalists, wherever they are in the world, if they are inclined to do what they're supposed to do and expose the secrets of the empire when it entails illegality and war crimes.
It's sending a message, or trying to send a message, that people who expose war crimes themselves will face imprisonment, themselves will face inhumane treatment in order to try and silence them. So I think it's important that we stand up for Julian Assange, not just for the sake of Julian and his family, but also for other journalists, also for other whistleblowers as well. And it's because of the work of Julian Assange that we know the horrors of Iraq. It's because of the work of Julian Assange that we know in detail about Guantanamo Bay and other travesties that have taken place. So actually, Julian Assange should be congratulated, not persecuted in the way he is being. The real question should be about holding to account those who have taken us to war, holding to account those who are responsible for human rights abuses. And Julian Assange has shed a light upon those things, and he's paying a heavy, heavy price for that.
And that concludes today's edition of COVID, Race and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and its radio affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. Today's show was produced by Steve Zeltzer, with editing by Paulina Vasiliev. Our executive producers are Akua Holt, Paulina Vasiliev, and Steve Zeltzer. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, covidtaskforce.pacifica.org. Make sure you click the subscribe button. You can also follow us on Twitter at PacificaCRD and on Facebook at COVID, Race and Democracy. I've been your host, Paulina Vasiliev. Thanks for listening. On COVID, Race and Democracy, we'll spend the hour bringing you excerpts of a remarkable event this past weekend in New York. It's called the International Tribunal on U.S. Human Rights Abuses Against Black, Brown, and Indigenous Peoples, organized by the Spirit of Mandela, a coalition of organizers, academics, clergy, attorneys, and advocacy organizations committed to working against the systemic, historic, and ongoing human rights violations and abuses committed by the United States. there was an independent 9-member panel of jurists, including some with international stature, the majority of whom were women and rooted in the Global South. The tribunal's verdict was just submitted to the United Nations. Tune into a roundup of the tribunal coming up on next week's edition of COVID, Race, and Democracy on this station. For more information on the tribunal, go to tribunal2021.com.